This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Robin Antelek about her novel called The Grown-Ups. And really, I loved reading this book. It was really fun and amazingly kind of easy writing style that made it easy to read. How are you, Robin?
I'm fine. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. I like the cover of the book too, by the way. Often authors don't have much to do with the actual cover, but it's a beautiful photograph. I really liked it.
It is gorgeous, and I have to say, HarperCollins, William Morrow, the whole team, every step of the way, they're amazingly great at keeping me informed and asking my opinion, and the art direction team came up with a bunch of different photographs, and that was one that we unanimously loved. So it was pretty easy.
Well, it's great, and it's evocative, but without, covers shouldn't try to tell the story of the book. So I thought it's an attractive image that made you wonder what was going on, which I think is good.
Right. It's also interesting that you get someone's visual viewpoint, because they've read the book and they're just showing me, based upon their reading visually, something that they take from the book, which I find fascinating. Like, why that? But that's something that they really felt, spoke about the book in general,
So. Well, no, that's an interesting point. I'd never really thought about that from an author's perspective, the cover choice is not, it's a form of communication, recognizing the meaning of the book back to you, reflecting it back to you. That's actually a really interesting point.
Right.
And maybe sometimes I've heard from authors more than once that they were not happy with the cover, that it didn't speak to them, and that mm-hmm. the cover was, they felt, was too much a function of sales, of trying to sell the book.
Right.
And I guess you feel better about this cover, that it may be good for sales, but it actually speaks to the book.
Yeah, it does. It does. They did ask me if there was anything I didn't like. And I said, the only thing I'm really not fond of is the recent trend of showing women from the back. I don't know why that's a trend in book jackets lately, but that was my one caveat. Just maybe don't show me a cover with a woman from the back.
Well, that's good. Yeah, no, I think I understand that you're thinking about that. And, the book covers do have a sort of look and feel of the moment from time to time. And especially maybe, different categories within fiction will have similar covers, because if something's successful, you want to tell the reader, if you read book A, you might like this book.
Right.
So there's that tendency to reflect, and maybe, I don't want to say copy, but yeah, copy mm-hmm. somebody else's success, not because you're being a copyist, but because you're trying to communicate to the reader who read that first book, this is a book of similar vein.
Absolutely.
And, and of course, that's actually leads to a question for me. I felt this book, I guess we should talk a little bit about it, that it's you might call it an ensemble. It's about a number of characters in a gathering of friends. And there's this, I felt like there were really three main characters who come through with the most time and attention, even though there are more characters than that mm-hmm. in the book. There's the primary grouping, which is Sam, who when you open is 15 years old, Bella, Susie, Susie Epstein, who is his almost girlfriend, let's say, at 15,
right.
And then Bella, who's Susie's best friend, with whom he later becomes involved. So those three felt to me the core of the book. Mm-hmm. And, maybe you could talk a little bit about just the setting where, you get a strong feeling it's suburban New York.
Yeah.
I later, as I read, I discovered what town, but at the beginning, it's sort of a suburban town near New York.
Right.
And it feels like this is they're born in the mid-80s. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
So as of today, if they were talking to us, they would be either 30-year-olds or almost coming up on 30.
Right. Right.
So this is the 30-something for this generation, maybe.
Right, right.
I don't think that's your generation.
It is not my generation, no. I was born in 1961, so it's not my generation. And it's not quite my daughter's generation either. I have two daughters, one who's 20 and one who's 23. So it was just an interesting time. I sort of felt because technology wasn't quite a part of everyday life then. They sort of, you know, worked their way into technology. And I think that the friendships and the relationships are almost, I don't know if innocent is the right word, but it was a little bit less complicated to be with your friends than maybe it is now. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I can see that. And do you feel? But did you feel drawn to the I guess I should say, what drew you? Beside that, were there kids at a certain point that you identified with in this to inspire you in this story?
Well, I will tell you that the first sentence of the book was something I overheard. I had recently decided to shelve a novel that I had been working on for 2 years after my first novel. And I really was at, you know, loose ends as to what my next subject was going to be, where was I going. And I was sitting on the floor in the used bookstore at our local library. And there were two elderly volunteers, and they were just chatting at the desk. And I was looking through a pile of books that I had on the floor in front of me. And one of the women said to the other, "It was the summer all of the children had a virus." But for some strange reason, that sentence stuck in my head. I wrote it down inside the cover of one of the books I bought. I thought about it and thought about it and thought about it. And pretty soon I had a neighborhood of kids. And I wasn't even really quite specific at that moment. Like, would it be like in my generation, like in the 60s, the 70s, or, you know, would I make it a little bit older? And I decided in the end to make them be just, you know, like children of the 80s and 90s. So,
and of course, in some ways, I was thinking about this, that, you know, let's say there's a genre of novels set in suburbia, which mm-hmm. I think, you know, one could say, I mean, it's not really a genre, but in a way, because it covers so much territory. I mean, we could be talking about John Cheever and, you know, and we could talk about, you know, anything from the 50s upward, where suburbia, mm-hmm. modern suburbia mm-hmm. as we know it, a setting for fiction becomes possible, let's say.
Right.
So you've got 60, 70 years potentially of fiction taking place in modern suburbia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's sort of an interesting thought. Do you feel that there's a certain commonality that suburbia, even though it's different, the 80s are way different from the 60s and way different right. from the aughts of today. But is there a certain commonality of experience because of the physical layout of suburbs? And because, and you know, interestingly, you live in Saratoga Springs, and there's a writer there named James Howard Kunstler, you may know of.
Yes, I do.
Who's written extensively about suburbia. As a nonfiction writer. And, you know, Jim has a lot of really interesting things to say about suburbia, not good, but
right.
it has fostered an amazing number of novels.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like having a captive audience, right? You're basically, you become sort of friends with people because you live near them. And they're outside when you're outside. And, you know, neighbors become more than neighbors because people end up, you know, having barbecues or having parties or banding together for some reason. I think it's a little bit easier to form almost a, I don't want to say a mock family or a second family, but those people become very integral to your day-to-day life more so than if you had to go out and choose a group of friends and then actively get in your car and drive to see them, almost, you know? They may not be the people that your first choice was, let's say, but they become your group.
Right, in the case of this novel, they become the group for life.
Right.
Which is, I don't think that's uncommon, although it may not be always true. You know, I certainly grew up in suburbia where it would be a struggle or a reach to say that I'm very close to people that I grew up with. But I'm sure for some people, the bonds are very strong and relationships continue. And of course, in your story, what happened in that suburban setting this summer when everyone got the virus, there were other things that happened that were very powerful and changed lives.
Right.
And those things resonate throughout the book.
Yeah.
Particularly for Sam, your main character, who seems to be the most, he's not the most complicated character, but he's certainly the one for whom life is hardest.
And whether he makes it that way for himself or whether it just happens. Originally, the book was written entirely in first person in Sam's voice. So I, you know, saw this kind of overachieving brother and Sam, the underachieving or lost brother, you know, that natural sort of pitting against each other. And this guy just really basically not knowing what was going on around him, and maybe sometimes making the concerted effort not to know when he could know, you know, when he really could be more informed. He really sort of intrigued me, that kind of guy, you know. I think sort of male characters in general have a tendency to not always get what's happening around them. So it was easy.
Well, yeah. I think that, you know, it is interesting when you think about the male persona and the, you know, way that men write books and what they think about and what is interesting to them, you know, and again, it's not uniform. It's not that all male writers are one way and all female writers are another, and all male characters, it isn't uniform, but it is true. The things that a lot of male characters think about, reflecting what a lot of men think about, often not the emotional life on the same level that Sam has.
Right.
And, I mean, he is clueless in one level, but on another level, it's because he is a sensitive person. You know, he is open to emotion and confused by and not clear about what his place is. And, you know, he's kind of classically adrift. And it may be, you have, there are reasons for that. You have him in his family, his mother leaves at a particular time in his life.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what it is. It's impossible to, just like it is with real life. You know, you can't say that a person is a certain way because of a single event. But maybe they are. You know, from their perspective, maybe they are.
Right.
So that does make it interesting.
It does make it interesting because you're also not quite clear as to what the catalyst is for sort of the introspection or the emotion. Like, there's a lot of times in the book that Sam knows he should feel a certain way, but purposely tries not to. You know, it's like he's making a conscious decision not to feel that way, when if he had just let himself go, it would have been a lot easier, you know, in some ways. So I just found writing Sam's voice very fulfilling. I really, really enjoyed it.
You liked him, I think.
And I liked Sam a lot, yes.
But you also,
I didn't want Sam to fail.
Right. No, you can tell. I mean, there's the fulfillment. I never want to give away plot, but, and so we shouldn't talk about what happens at the end at all, but, even though you just alluded to, but he has this older brother that you're able to contrast him with, you know, the older brother, Michael, who is much more, let's say, classically successful, directed, knows what he's doing, works, he's driven, and he's the one who goes to the Ivy League school, he's the one who becomes a doctor, and you have Sam, of course, you know, he could be a surfer or a ski bum, you know, he's that kind of a guy. He ends up being this is very modern, you know, he ends up being food bum, let's say, right. Restaurant bum.
Right, yeah, exactly. Not a classically trained chef, but he loves right. food and he likes to cook and, yeah.
Right, and I sort of could recognize that character in this age group. You know, he might end up in Brooklyn, you know, with a restaurant of his own or an artisanal cheese factory or something. He's that kind of a guy.
He is that kind of a guy.
Right. And, but you know, I thought that I love your characters. I thought they were very, compelling. And I kept, you know, I was thinking about them a lot in terms of not necessarily do I recognize that person as a real character, but you know, that they are, they're characters, they're real people. They're, maybe not real people, but they could be real people. And that's what, I think that's, I like that. It was, you know, realistic novel in the sense that these are all people who could be people you meet and recognize them. And maybe that's good for them, potentially, those readers, to see themselves, you know, although maybe it isn't possible for them to read a novel written by somebody not of their age group. You know, I don't know. That's another interesting thing, you know, when you think about fiction or film, you know, there are some generational things that are different. The perspective of a 25-year-old isn't the same as the perspective of an older person writing about a 25-year-old.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I did purposely try to be very careful to not put my my generational perspective onto my characters. You know, I think that's a little hard to sometimes.
You don't want to sort of inadvertently be judging them.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But I have to say, as a writer, that's such a compliment that you paid to me to say that you were thinking about these characters, because ultimately that is my goal. I mean, I want to tell the best story that I can tell, and I want you to feel for these people, you know, like you know them, or like there's somebody, you know, you could meet and not feel that, you know, they're some stock character that I just needed to introduce to get a scene moving along, you know. I mean, I really, ultimately, as a writer, my goal is to get the reader to really be invested in the characters.
Yeah.
And if I do that, then I figure that, you know, I've done my job, and that's a great thing to hear, really.
Well, and it did feel like, and maybe this is how you wrote it, I was not sure, but that, it, and I may be thinking that more now that you said that the book is inspired by a single line, kind of makes me think that the narrative was a function of the characters coming to life, not that the narrative was first and the characters second. In other words,
absolutely. Right. Yes. The characters were really coming to life. And it sounds sort of on the edge of, you know, sanity when I say that Sam kind of arrived fully formed in my head. That first image of Sam arrived fully formed. You know, I saw him, this 15-year-old, getting, you know, a kiss and being in the basement and seeing these, you know, photographs and not really sure what was going on and the confusion of the moment. And that kid was incredibly real to me, and I feel like generationally it didn't matter where he was. It was the emotion of the child,
right,
you know, that that I felt in that thing. And then all the other kids sort of, you know, it all snowballed, and they all came together. And I don't have any friends from childhood, but I thought it was really kind of neat that this group of people sort of stayed in touch with each other, maybe because geography was a part of their, you know, life. They all kept returning to the same neighborhood. I don't have that as an adult, but I thought, hey, what if? And it just sort of went from there.
Right. Well, I think in America, my observation is most of us do not have that continuity, and either in either place or in friendships or love relationships, you know, where you're not most people It's such a mobile culture, and we're all going off to do things in other places than where we grew up. Most people end up splintering those relationships, but not all, and not in all places. And, you know, I grew up in suburbia, much, you know, probably like a lot of people. And I know there are some people who it's not that they stayed, but as you have them, there's a return, you know, and that people do, you know, groups of people have kept in touch, in a complicated way, not just through Facebook, you know, and
in real life way.
Right. Right. And, you know, in a more powerful way.
Yes.
And I do think that there is a certain, commonality over generations in the, you know, that I was trying to get at before, that, you know, from, let's say, the 50s onward through today, where you have people growing up in these suburban settings, and it's possible to go through school with people from kindergarten to high school, you know, with some comings and goings, but you can have those long-term growing up relationships. There is a certain amount of commonality of experience between something that happened if you were, you know, 10 in 1960 and 10 in 1980 and 10 in, or 15,
absolutely,
you know, whatever that age is.
Right.
Some of those things are true. And that's that first kiss thing that you got, I thought, very beautifully. And not just the first, but the first summer of being sexually aware, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, you know, maybe today it's 12 or 13 instead of 15 or 16 because,
You
know, mores have changed and behaviors changed.
Right.
But still, I think those kinds of relationship developing moments are common.
Right. And that is a universal feeling, whatever generation you are in, that first of anything, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think also what it has a lot to do about, going back to the neighborhood thing, if your parents stay in one place, you are more likely probably to keep a thread of a relationship.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's absolutely true. I see it in certain places where there is more continuity. I think in a lot of suburban places, people leave because once they've raised their children, you know, the taxes are high. They don't want to live there anymore. They want to retire. Whatever the things are that get them to go, a lot of people leave. But then, like, as I was saying before, I think there are pockets of people or places where people stay. And maybe more, you know, maybe those, I think you're right. If the parents are there, then there's more reason for people to come back. And there's more of a community in that literal sense.
Yeah.
And what community is really what is important there.
Right.
You know, if, you know, I guess the criticism of suburbia is that it is alienating for a lot of people, but I think that there are places, and maybe it is the kind of suburban neighborhood you're talking about in this book, where the houses are fairly close together. It's an established suburbia, and, you know, not a 2-acre zoning suburbia.
Right, where, not a development suburbia.
Yeah, you're talking about nearer New York, where the neighborhoods are more established.
Yes, absolutely.
And, you know, I can think of some movies, and also where you could bicycle, you know, where you can actually go to visit your friends before you have cars.
Right.
I think that's an important component of that geographically.
Absolutely. That independent mobility without being old enough to drive is important. Yeah.
Yeah. So the 15-year-olds can hang out together without a huge struggle, which is, again, that's another way that relationships are developed and built that would enable what happens in your book to happen, which is for the bonds to be close enough that people would want to stay together or come back to a relationship with someone they knew when they were 15 because their relationship is stronger.
Right, right.
Now, you also do get a little bit into, as the, you know, there's a certain, you know, as the characters age. So, in your book, they go from 15 to mid-20s, let's say.
Yeah.
Other things happen in their families, which I thought also was evocative. And I wonder, you know, I assumed you might have had some experience with this because the way you wrote about the aging parents. You know, that seems to also be a feature of, you know, the life for anybody who is, well, anybody at this point, you know, it, as, right. you know, that you have to deal with the vicissitudes of your parents' aging.
Right. We don't exist in a bubble, you know, so therefore to, and what I really liked was the relationship between not only Sam and his friends or Sam and his brother, but Sam and his father and some of the other characters, Bella and her mother and father and, you know, Susie and her parents, however difficult or sad or, you know, happy they may be, you know, for better or for worse, these are, you know, your family members. And to have the characters sort of exist in this little bubble where whatever happens within the family, they're not responsible for, or they're not beholden to, or, you know, they don't ever return to. Well, I think that's unrealistic. You know, we're all dealing, we're all sandwiched between generations. So, I felt like each character sort of had a responsibility to their family, however fractious the relationships may have been. And I wanted to really kind of play that out on the page because I think that that's just natural plot progression, you know?
No, it's true. Well, you need to be accurate, but I also think it it does require a certain sensitivity on the, you know, or as you just described, you're more interested in that. And some writers maybe would not have even thought of that, would have just focused on the characters and, you know, everything else would be kind of background, a grayness, just because you need to have some, you know, you need the characters in the background, but you engaged across the generation. So the parents were also real people. So clearly, you know, you're a people writer.
Yes. Yes. And it will always be this way for me. I think, you know, family relationships, friends, lovers, whatever, that I'm infinitely fascinated with the entanglements of that, you know, and I will write those characters until the end because I just find them very fascinating.
So now you've written, this is your second book.
It is.
And I know, you know, for a while you'll be involved in, talking about this book, you know, it's going to be out there and you'll be promoting but so how does that work for you in terms of a next book? Are you already thinking about it? Have you got something in mind, or do you need to take a break once one book is done and you have to wait for the inspirational moment for the next book?
Well, you know, I'd like to say that it's the idea of the writer sitting around waiting for inspiration is a great thing, but I've really trained myself to just work every day regardless. And I'm always thinking about something. I'm not a real journaler, but I'm a clipper, you know, like I'll tear out images or articles or obituaries, and I keep them in a little notebook, and sometimes I jot a word down or two next to them that I find sort of like, you know, a question, a what if kind of thing. So I always have that, and I'm always sort of thinking, but I told you that I had shelved a novel that I worked on for 2 years in between the first and this novel, and my agent really, really loved those characters, and she had posed a question to me, taking the main character out of the story that I had written, and said, you know, I think really it just belongs to her, because I had had a multi-viewpoint, and she said, I really think maybe we just need to explore her. And so I'm thinking about possibly going back into that, so I've been toying with that a little bit.
Well, that's good. Well, obviously, you also could have the same experience since you're doing, it sounds like you allow inspiration to occur sometimes from other places than your rational brain. So you never know. Right? You might be in another bookstore talking about this book and someone will say something that will spur a new book.
That was a very, very strange thing. I can't even tell you what these ladies were really talking about. I don't even know what the conversation was before or after. It was that one sentence, and that was it. So
no, that's wonderful, though. I think
they don't even know.
Right. Well, maybe they will, but maybe they'll find out, you know, by reading this book. But I do think that is a wonderful image for me to think about, you know, and that is the one line that you hear from that an entire world could be created. I think that's pretty cool.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I keep saying it was a gift because I feel like it was one of those gifts, and I'm actually recognizing that it was one of those gifts. So, yeah, I just really, to say everything just fell into place after that, I'm not minimizing the amount of work it took, but it really became easy. I could just see this neighborhood. So that part at least was great because I could visualize it.
No, that is great. Well, I really, I think it's a wonderful book. I hope it's very successful. I really did enjoy it.
Oh, thank you so much.
So thank you, Robin. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Robin Antelek about The Grown-Ups, a novel, and I really recommend it. Thanks.